As they travel at such high speeds, we see them living 10 times longer before they decay, and as a result, reaching much deeper into Earth's atmosphere than they should. If you don't happen to be going as fast as a muon, you'll still experience a little time dilation. Spend 6 months on the International Space Station, which is traveling 5 miles per second around Earth, a mere 0.0027% the speed of light, and you will have aged 0.005 seconds less than everybody else on Earth. 3. Since everything warmer than absolute zero radiates heat, detecting infrared at a distance means, in principle, detecting everything. Period. As a result, every astrophysicist, as well as every general, counter-revolutionary, spy, cop, and drone that needs to identify an otherwise invisible target could search for it in infrared. But what the warfighter must also do is distinguish what is from what is not a threat. Simply detecting a patch of oddly intense infrared isn't enough. Surveillance need to know the heat signature of their target so they can isolate and differentiate it from the manifold other infrared sources that crowd the theater of operations. Out there in the cosmos, the cooler residents, those with temperatures below about 1,000 kelvins, 700 degrees Celsius, which includes planets, failed stars, cosmic dust, and assorted clouds in galaxies, especially those about to give birth to star systems, emit more infrared than any other band of light. Anything hotter than that also begins to glow in the visible part of the spectrum, rendering it plainly visible to anybody looking, initially appearing red hot, but then as its temperature rises further, white hot, and finally blue hot. So if you want to see cool objects, best use an infrared telescope. Also, infrared light escapes clouds of gas and dust much more readily than does visible light, even when the visible light is highly luminous. This is where an all-sky survey and the U.S. Air Force's Infrared Celestial Backgrounds Program enter the picture. To distinguish the infrared signature of a missile in the sky headed for the presidential palace from the infrared signature of a cosmic object, the general needs a sky map. The general provides the funding. The astrophysicist provides the map. Whereas the discovery of gamma ray bursts was a serendipitous byproduct of the normal work of military surveillance, comprehensive infrared sky maps were the intentional result of a military initiative meant to furnish surveillance with a necessary tool. As an Air Force fact sheet explains it, ballistic missile defense is an important mission with the need to develop technologies for detecting and tracking theater and strategic ballistic missiles from launch to intercept. Effective tracking of cold body and dim targets in the IR spectral region requires the IR signature of the target to be distinguished from the background against which the target is observed. The issue is that the background can mask or mimic the target. Therefore, a key technical goal is to measure and model the full range of backgrounds, particularly challenging backgrounds, in order to design IR sensor systems which will maximize the visibility of the target signature. This problem is not unique to infrared. Any measurement of anything by any means risks getting confused with background noise. We're all familiar with literal noise. An intimate conversation between you and a loved one can occur without confusion in a quiet room, whereas at a crowded cocktail party, you will need to speak well above a whisper to be heard and understood, to be detected. Noise includes any unwanted signal that contaminates the target of measurement. When the earliest infrared investigations took place, Most scientists presumed radiant heat and visible light to be two different things, although in 1835, André-Marie Ampère published a note proposing that they were both the result of vibratory motion. Early IR detectors were upgraded versions of the thermometer, suited to modest achievements such as measuring the heat signature of a cow a quarter mile away. But in the summer of 1878, when infrared wasn't yet called infrared, its discoverer, William Herschel, had used the term calorific rays, an unnamed commentator in Scientific American described Thomas Alva Edison's ambitious proposal for a sky survey of invisible sources of heat. To carry out the survey, Edison's own heat-sensitive astronomical invention, the tessimeter, would be attached to a large telescope in order to explore those parts of the heavens which appear blank. Hitherto, science has given no hint of the possibility of exploring the vast and mysterious beyond, from which no visible ray of light has ever been detected or is ever likely to be detected by the most far-reaching and sensitive of optic aids. But now there comes a promise of an extension of positive knowledge to fields of space so remote that light is tired out and lost before it can traverse the intervening distance. If at any point in such blank space the tessimeter indicates an accession of temperature and does this invariably, the legitimate inference will be that the instrument is in range with a stellar body, either non-luminous or so distant as to be beyond the reach of vision assisted by the telescope. Possibly, too, it may bring within human ken a vast multitude of nearer bodies, burnt-out suns, or feebly reflecting planets, now unknown because not luminous. Fast forward to the USA during the Cold War. Ballistic missiles are installed far and wide. Broad sky surveys have already been done, but nothing big at infrared wavelengths. In 1963, the Air Force creates an infrared physics branch within its research laboratories, and the Infrared Celestial Backgrounds program begins. Not every researcher turned directly to the Air Force for funding. In 1965, for instance, two enterprising astrophysicists at Caltech embarked on an infrared sky survey tuned to a wavelength of 2.2 millionths of a meter. That's 2.2 microns in astrophysical parlance, where one micron equals about 1/20th the width of a human hair. At this band, Earth's atmosphere happens to be 80% transparent. Some war surplus hardware, a ground-based telescope, a homemade 5-foot reflector, and NASA funding enabled the investigators to produce a catalog of the brightest 5,600 objects in the northern hemisphere skies, many of them never seen by visible light telescopes, and a number of them stunningly gigantic and distant. Under the title 2-Micron Sky Survey, NASA published their work in 1969. The next major infrared survey, the AFCRL Infrared Sky Survey, did have the Air Force's imprimatur. This was a true military astrophysical collaboration conducted in the late 1960s and early 1970s under the auspices of the Air Force Cambridge Research Laboratories at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts and sponsored in part by the Advanced Research Projects Agency. This time the telescope was built by Hughes Aircraft. The survey itself, implemented via rockets prepared and launched by the U.S. Naval Ordnance Missile Test Facility at White Sands, observed the sky through three longer wavelength bands than in the prior survey, 4, 11, and 20 microns, and resulted in a catalog of 3,200 objects covering almost 90% of the sky. Therein lies just one of the many advantages of an orbiting telescope. It can access the entire sky, both northern and southern hemispheres. A notable feature of both this survey and its predecessor is that the published report was not classified. So all scientists, no matter what they may have been investigating, would have open access to the data. The same held true for a comprehensive follow-up study, published in 2003. The 2-micron all-sky survey, 2MASS, covering 99.998% of the sky and providing IR brightness and coordinate data on 471 million objects. Stephen Price, co-author of the AFCRL Infrared Sky Survey, writes that for most of his half-century career in infrared astronomy, he was supported by the Air Force, primarily through the AFCRL, and was glad of it, because he not only found himself in a position to do cutting-edge research that was personally highly rewarding, but also found the related practical Air Force space surveillance problems both interesting and challenging. His detailed history of the close post-war partnership between astrophysics and the military brims with references to corporations, universities, branches of the Department of Defense, distinguished investigators, significant discoveries, and the intricate braid of military needs and astrophysical quests. Price also chronicles the continual bureaucratic reshuffling and renaming within military research structures, as well as the effects of the Mansfield Amendment to the Fiscal Year 1970 Military Procurement Authorization Act, which mandated that the Department of Defense could not use its funds to carry out any research project or study unless such project or study has a direct and apparent relationship to a specific military function. Passed in late 1969 during the Vietnam War, in the context of the general public disenchantment with both science and the military at the time, the amendment intended to trigger increased scrutiny briefly led to reductions in personnel and reorganization of responsibilities. The Fiscal Year 1971 Authorization Act turned the amendment's intentions upside down. Now funding decisions would be based on the opinion of the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary, a member of the President's Cabinet, would be free to opine on whether projects had a potential relationship to a military function or operation. The words direct, apparent, and specific were gone from the legislation. Whatever the true effects of the Mansfield Amendment, Price's account shows the enduring strength and breadth of military support for both basic space science and utilitarian space science. Few projects could be of greater direct use to both the military and the astrophysicists than an infrared sky map, though of course military support flowed to other infrared projects as well, both before, during, and after the amendment. Martin Harwit, former director of the National Air and Space Museum and an IR astronomer himself, writes that the development of infrared detectors, the instruments without which IR astronomy could not exist, was largely guided not by astronomers, but by military needs, such as night vision, enabling warm objects to be discerned in the dark. Science historian Ronald E. Dole agrees, referring specifically to U.S. research on planetary atmosphere, the region on Earth through which every ballistic missile must pass. These programs introduced astronomers to military agencies eager to fund astronomical research. Military patronage helped maintain the viability of American observatories in the lean years of 1946 and 1947. However, military contract funding also encouraged researchers to design proposals with short-term solutions. Those projects that did not achieve these promised ends faced heightened risk of disruption or discontinuance regardless of their scientific merit. This bound researchers more closely with military missions as the Cold War deepened. But it was the All-Sky Survey that provided data on the largest possible scale. The infrared sky map characterized the enduring cosmic backdrop against which a real-time incoming threat, whether a ballistic missile or an asteroid, must be distinguished. In war or in peace, this intelligence was and remains vital to national security. In fact, sky surveys have yielded military value not merely because of their infrared info. Take the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, an unprecedentedly ambitious wide-area survey designed to gather ultraviolet, visible light, and infrared brightness readings for hundreds of millions of stars and galaxies, and spectra for millions more. To achieve its ends, SDSS uses a single-purpose telescope at the Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico, and a unique calibrated measurement system and data pipeline invented just for these observations. Begun in the 1990s, and as of 2018, deep into its fourth survey, and funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, this gargantuan undertaking by hundreds of investigators and dozens of institutions around the world has outstripped all previous ground-based sky surveys in accuracy, scale, and value to astrophysicists. From its inception, SDSS's central tasks were daunting: the management and analysis of the prodigious quantities of raw data obtained by the telescope. Innovative software to the rescue. So clever, efficient, and effective were the algorithms to turn the light of cosmic objects into analyzable data that SDSS research papers on the analytics of astrophysical data streams appeared not in astrophysics circles, but at the 2012 International Conference on High-Performance Computing, Networking, Storage, and Analysis, and the 2014 IEEE High-Performance Extreme Computing Conference. The U.S. Department of Defense ultimately took note, and in a reversal of the more usual direction of requests for assistance, asked one of the Sky Survey's project leaders, Alexander S. Zale, Johns Hopkins Professor of Astronomy and Computer Science, as well as Director of the Institute for Data Intensive Engineering and Science, to brief a key branch of the Pentagon on how SDSS processed and analyzed stupendous data flows obtained from images and spectra. An instance of astrophysical inventiveness spurred by the quest for more comprehensive knowledge of the universe and subsequently enlisted in the service of national security. 4. The high-energy profile of X-rays, like gamma rays, demands a telescope of very different concept and design from the ones that focus and detect visible light. X-rays are among the several bands of light that do not reach Earth's surface. Our atmospheric layer of ozone simply and completely absorbs them. In the absence of observing platforms above Earth's atmosphere, X-ray phenomena in the universe go unnoticed. Enter the Italian-born American astrophysicist Riccardo Jaconi. Beginning in the late 1950s, he applied himself to the task of perfecting such a telescope. Until the space age came about and we could put instruments on satellites and rockets, he said later in life, we couldn't find out what was out there. So by looking in X-rays, you are seeing aspects of nature which we did not even suspect existed, but which are very important in the formation, evolution, and dynamics of the structures in the universe. Jaconi is credited, in fact, with fathering the field of cosmic X-ray astronomy. In 1959, as a young scientist, Jaconi joined American Science and Engineering, ASE, a company formed the previous year by a group of investigators from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In its early days, the company specialized in making scientific instruments for NASA. But while Jaconi and his team did space science, for example, photographing the sun in X-rays and discovering the first stellar X-ray source, ASE began to branch out into medical and security technology. Today, the homepage of the company's website highlights its assistance to military and law enforcement personnel who face challenges at borders, at ports, and in conflict zones. ASE systems facilitate such procedures as cargo screening, threat detection for military personnel, bomb detection, and drug interdiction. Security is the emphasis. X-rays are the enabler. The hijacking of commercial airplanes, often American, presented an especially high-profile security challenge during the late 1960s and early 1970s. Cuba, which was subject to a Kennedy-era Cold War trade embargo, rendering it off-limits to airline traffic from the United States, was a frequent destination for political dissidents until early 1969, when congressional hearings revealed that, after arriving in Cuba, hijackers were subjected to lengthy interrogation followed by hard labor. Soon, the aims of air pirates expanded to include extortion of ransom money, political blackmail, and terrorist revenge. Worldwide in 1969 alone, there were 86 hijackings, an average of more than one every 4 days. American carriers were the most common target. Clearly, the aviation industry needed to screen passengers and their luggage for weapons and explosive devices. ASE, which had already developed X-ray telescopes for NASA and a parcel X-ray system for the U.S. Postal Service, was able to provide a machine to do precisely that. By late 1972, passenger screening stations had been set up in most U.S. airports. Hijackings plummeted. In early 1973, a Nevada senator introduced legislation to require that before boarding an aircraft, all passengers and all property intended to be carried in the aircraft cabin in air transportation be screened by weapon-detecting procedures or facilities before boarding. It became law in 1974. Thenceforth, all carry-ons would be scanned at all airports. ASE scanners were everywhere. During this period, and continuing for several decades, Jaconi would be the principal investigator on 4 NASA X-ray telescopes, starting with the first one ever, Uhuru, launched in 1970, and continuing through the flagship observatory, Chandra, launched in 1999. For pioneering the discovery of highly energetic phenomena in the universe, including black holes dining on stars that have orbited too close, and indeed for birthing an entire subfield of astrophysics, he would share the 2002 Nobel Prize in Physics and receive the 2003 President's National Medal of Science. At that time, I was serving on the 12-member National Science Foundation Committee tasked with recommending the National Medal of Science recipients to the President. The awards ceremony, to which the committee is of course invited, is held annually at the White House. The ceremony for the 2003 winners took place in March 2005. That's when I met Ricardo for the first time. As we passed together through the visitor's foyer, a semi-detached security area adjoining the east wing of the White House. Queuing to be scanned, screened, and scrutinized, we placed our belongings on the conveyor belt of an X-ray machine. Its maker, American Science and Engineering, ASE. 5. If you like the universe at all, you've probably seen many of the Hubble Space Telescope's gorgeous images of galaxies and nebulae. What you might not have come across is the fact that Hubble is basically a photo-reconnaissance satellite whose cameras point upward at the heavens rather than downward at Earth. During the late 1980s and early 1990s, Eric J. Chason served as a senior scientist and director of educational programs at Hubble's Scientific Nerve Center, the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, just below his original preface to his 1994 book, The Hubble Wars, is a note that reads like a legal disclaimer. No part of this book divulges sensitive military intelligence material not previously having entered the public domain. I have been scrupulous about neither identifying reconnaissance assets unknown to the public, nor disclosing the specific capabilities of any known yet classified project. Right off the bat, the reader is alerted to the largely unspoken and unseen military aspects of this signal achievement of human ingenuity, an instrument that most people around the world know only as a gateway to the glories of the cosmos. But once Chason reveals the connections between the Hubble Space Telescope and a certain spy satellite in the top-secret Keyhole series, it becomes clear why he added his disclaimer. A couple of decades later, he wouldn't have needed to be quite so cautious, since that particular keyhole was declassified in 2011 and put on view for one whole day at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. When a military program is secret or top secret, mentioning its existence or its code name is verboten. Keyhole, according to a 1964 security memo, was the name given to the product obtained from U.S. reconnaissance operations from satellites. Capsules of exposed film dropped back to Earth were the main but not the only product. SIGINT, Signals Intelligence, based on the monitoring and interception of radar and electronic communications, was the other product. The name Keyhole is now also given to the overall camera system used by the reconnaissance satellites, or more generally, the satellites themselves. To add another layer of obfuscation, the early keyholes were part of the Corona program overseen by the CIA. The keyhole that Chason obliquely referenced was, it may now be said openly, the jumbo 60-foot-long KH-9 Hexagon. The National Reconnaissance Office, whose very existence was classified for 30 years until 1992, launched 20 of them between 1971 and 1986. Repeatedly, the KH-9 has been described as being either the size of or larger than a school bus. The same comment has often been made about the Hubble, although the Hubble is a little shorter and less massive than the KH-9. Even before its 2011 declassification, writers would comment every now and again that the KH-9, aka Big Bird, looked like a twin of the Hubble. Not a coincidence. Both could fit equally well lengthwise into the now-retired Space Shuttle's cargo bay or atop a heavy-lift Titan-class rocket. Both were fitted with long, narrow solar arrays angled away from their bodies. The biggest differences between the two were that the Hubble focuses at infinity and takes prolonged exposures of extremely dim and distant objects, while the KH-9 focused mostly between 100 and 200 miles down on Earth's surface and took quick exposures. When Hubble points at Earth, which it does only occasionally to help calibrate the telescope's cameras, it registers only smudges and blurs because it cannot focus that closely. When the KH-9's precision mapping camera and twin panoramic rotating cameras pointed at Earth, mostly at the Soviet Union, they registered features such as missile silos, shipyards, airfields, rocket test facilities, submarine bases, even an ICBM under construction, with a resolution of 2 feet and a horizontal range of more than 400 miles. In addition, Hubble carries no fuel, whereas the KH-9 had plenty of fuel so that it could change course and make multiple passes over sites of interest. Early in its post-launch life, Hubble exhibited a bad case of the jitters, bad enough that its capacity to do the long, steady exposures required by scientific research would be seriously undercut if a cure couldn't be found. It was. Orbiting Earth once every 96 minutes, Hubble shuddered each time it entered or exited orbital night, total darkness, after spending 48 minutes in orbital day, blazing sunlight. 30 times every Earth day, Hubble pitched, oscillated, and wobbled as unobstructed heat from the reappearing sun increased the temperature in some parts of the telescope by more than 100 degrees Celsius within 90 seconds. Then, as the sun sank from view a mere 45 minutes later, the telescope would cool rapidly. The result, Hubble couldn't track a target for more than 10 minutes at a stretch. But the main culprit wasn't the telescope itself, which is swathed in heat-reflecting mylar. Blame the huge pair of solar arrays. Projecting well away from the vehicle and attached only at their center, framed in stainless steel rods and not positioned at the vehicle's center of mass, they bent and flapped too freely. Hubble's built-in compensatory measure, a hull that moves in the direction opposite to the array's displacement, couldn't fully overcome the unfortunate tendency of stainless steel to warp when assaulted by a sudden change in temperature. As soon as sunlight hit the array, the exposed side of the rods shot up to about 50 degrees Celsius, while the side that remained in shadow stayed at about minus 80 degrees. Each array, as Chason describes it, turned into a giant banana, a 40-foot longbow. As the go-to guy for the media, the White House, and anyone else who wanted substantive scientific information on the status of Hubble, Chason presumably knew how to be evasive yet accurate and how to keep control of what got said in public. Soon after the jitters were recognized, but before their cause was diagnosed, he was asked to appear at a closed meeting with several dozen officials involved in military intelligence work. The meeting was labeled secret and would be held at a secure location. Here's how Chason describes what happened. When I discussed the jitter enigma we were experiencing with Hubble, I was astonished to see so many nodding heads. Right then and there, midway through the briefing, a rage came over me. I felt like shouting, "Damn it! Why didn't you tell us?" For apparently, these people, some of whom were keyhole controllers, had years ago first noticed specifically this problem. Later that evening, I was stopped by a serious-looking person sporting short hair, gray suit, ID leash around his neck, and absolutely radiating that Woods are lovely, dark, and deep demeanor. He told me the name of someone to contact at Lockheed who, he said, might be able to help us. At which point, the intelligence operative did an about-face and marched away. Having passed along that name to the right person and plumbed other obvious channels, Chason began to grasp the closeness of the connections between Hubble and the series of 20 Hubble-class vehicles of whose existence he was aware. But since those vehicles, the KH-9 hexagons, remained classified until 2011, Chason would have been unaware in the 1990s of salient facts about them. As an Air Force intelligence officer saw fit to inform him one day at the Naval Academy, the Hubble was a keyhole-class satellite, not the other way around. In any case, Chason came to realize that neither ill will nor turf wars was the reason the military hadn't proactively shared its lessons learned. The jitter problem had been known for several years prior to Hubble's launch, but reconnaissance analysts were not bothered by it largely because they had never needed to expose their surveillance cameras for more than a fraction of a second. Whether peeking, for example, at work in progress at the Krasnoyarsk radar site, or sensing how many infrared-emitting people inhabit a specific tent outside Tripoli, spying spacecraft need not take long exposures. They can quickly gather their data whether the spacecraft is stable or oscillating. As a result, they probably did not pass along knowledge of it simply because it did not affect their landscape. The industrial contractors had compartmentalized their sensitive intelligence work so thoroughly that there was little or no cross-fertilization, and the civilian world was the loser. By the way, the Air Force wasn't the only branch of the military whose projects overlapped with Hubble. Another was the National Reconnaissance Office, the agency in charge of America's spy satellites. More unitary in its mission than the much larger U.S. Air Force, the NRO proactively aided one of NASA's foremost future civilian eyes in the sky, an instrument superior to Hubble. Every 10 years, the National Academy of Sciences facilitates a committee of U.S. astrophysicists to prioritize spending on projects for the upcoming decade, a process that establishes consensus in the field and precludes public arguments about whose pet project should receive federal support. Astrophysicists who raise their own money, personally or institutionally, can spend it however they wish. But when it's time to allocate federal or other shared funds, we follow the priorities of the report. Similar committees in earlier decades gave top ranking to the Very Large Array in New Mexico, the Hubble Telescope in orbit, and most recently, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile. In 2010, I served on one of these committees. Our final report, New Worlds, New Horizons, pegged the Spaceborne Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, WFIRST, as a number one priority. It promised to revolutionize infrared observations of the universe, whether of nearby exoplanets or of distant galaxies, and in NASA's words, to settle essential questions about dark energy. To make WFIRST happen meant we needed to drum up federal funding for the telescope's costly new mirror and detectors. Enter the NRO. Fortunately, for the future of astrophysics, the agency happened to have on hand two surplus, freshly declassified, Hubble-size, but better than Hubble-class telescope mirrors, and, in 2011, offered to donate them to NASA, stripped of their military-grade detectors. NASA, grateful for the gift, could now cross one big budget item off its fund-getting list. Why were these awesome mirrors now available? Because the NRO had begun to use even better ones. Unfortunately for the future of astrophysics, the White House's fiscal year 2019 budget request completely eliminates funding for WFIRST, on the grounds that developing another large space telescope immediately after completing the $8.8 billion James Webb Space Telescope is not a priority for the administration. Let's put that in context. For many years, NASA's budget, covering all 10 NASA centers, the astronaut program, the International Space Station, and all space probes and space-borne telescopes, including Hubble, has been less than one-half of 1% of the federal budget. A year and a half's fiscal year 2019 proposed funding for the Department of Defense roughly equals the entire run of NASA funding across the agency's 60-year history. How much is the universe worth to the president? How much is national security worth to Congress? How much is knowledge of our place in the cosmos worth to the electorate? As for Hubble itself, once the several post-launch problems were remedied via both emergency and pre-planned servicing missions, the telescope was able to begin its working life as a distinguished detective and impresario. On its roster of revelations are the age of the universe, exoplanets, supermassive black holes lurking at the heart of brilliant galaxies, embryonic planetary systems swathed in previously impenetrable disks of gas and dust surrounding young stars, a patch of sky chosen for how devoid of interesting galaxies it was when viewed with ordinary ground-based telescopes, but which, after a 10-day exposure by Hubble's camera, showed itself to be populated by thousands of distant galaxies dispersed to the edge of the universe. Hubble was adored not only by scientists, but by civilians, who, in 2004, took ownership of it. When NASA proposed to cancel the telescope's final servicing mission, the outcry from the general public was greater than that from the scientists. Congress relented, and the mission was reinstated. Hubble's successor, the infrared-tuned James Webb Space Telescope, has, as far as we know, no military doppelgangers. Yet. Chapter 7. Making War, Seeking Peace. Space is a physics battleground. Gigantic magnetic fields loop through the frigid emptiness. Bursts of plasma erupt from the surfaces of suns. Black holes flay and swallow every object that wanders near. Cosmic rays, gamma rays, and X-rays devastate any speck of living matter in their path. The infancy and youth of every planet consists of a ceaseless hail of rocks. Every day, millions of gigantic stars across the universe blow their metal-rich guts to smithereens, sending shockwaves and radiation across the light years. Whole galaxies, each containing hundreds of billions of stars, collide and merge, just as will happen with our own Milky Way, doomed to meet and greet the Andromeda Galaxy several billion years from now. Here in our solar system, 100-meter-wide asteroid sails into Earth every millennium or so at speeds upward of 50,000 miles an hour, generating a destructive impact equal to 2,500 atomic bombs. Some members of the human species have wanted to augment all that naturally occurring cosmic mayhem with some space apocalypses of their own doing. Barely had World War II ended when they embraced an even more devastating near-term scenario, the visiting of intentional nuclear disaster across the entire surface of Earth. Thus began a military shopping spree that continues to this day. By now, the wish list is quite long. Space war could take two main forms: direct physical attacks or cyber sabotage. Indeed, today's Air Force Space Command speaks of space and cyberspace in the same breath. Cyber war wouldn't require a physical weapon, only a focused disruption. The 1,700-plus operational satellites that circle Earth are the most obvious potential target. Nearly half of these are American, of which one-fifth are military, supporting contemporary technologies of warfare. As for the remaining satellites, the daily life of nearly every person in the world, but especially in the United States, depends on more than one of them, knowingly or unknowingly, directly or indirectly. Disable enough satellites by whatever means, and people suddenly can't use their credit cards. They have to reacquaint themselves with paper roadmaps and quickly unlearn their expectations of a reliable power grid and minute-by-minute updates on the weather. Think of cyber war against space assets as weaponless sabotage. Though weaponless can be hard to define, since almost anything from a hand to a fork to a truck to a plane can be and has been used as a weapon. Cyber war's potential reach is broader than that of all but the most unthinkable weapons. Space capabilities have proven to be significant force multipliers when integrated into military operations, state the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who stress space situational awareness, strategic deterrence, cyber support, and weaponless cyber interventions rather than space-to-space, air-to-space, or ground-to-space physical destruction, the kind of destruction that would result in huge new batches of space debris. Obviously, if shards and chunks of exploded satellites threaten anything and everything in their path, they're as likely to disrupt one's own space assets as the enemy's. No technologically advanced country welcomes the prospect of being thrown back to the days of the wax candle, the water well, and the electric telegraph, and so, compared with the other options, limited cyber attacks and non-nuclear space-to-ground destruction start to look positively reasonable. At the same time, the military knows its purpose, and that purpose does not end with awareness and deterrence. The commander of Air Force Space Command is clear about the mandate. Our job is to prepare for conflict. We hope this preparation will deter potential adversaries and that conflicts will not extend into space or cyberspace. But our job is to be ready when and if that day comes. In modern times, who are these potential adversaries? Notably, China, Russia, and China. Even the most cursory web search yields extensive evidence of America's alarm about the speed and scope of China's stunning achievements and ambitions in space. The Department of Defense's 2016 annual report to Congress concerning the Chinese military says that China has built a vast ground infrastructure supporting spacecraft and space launch vehicle, SLV, manufacturing, launch, C2, command and control, and data downlink, and that it continues to develop a variety of counter-space capabilities designed to limit or to prevent the use of space-based assets by adversaries during a crisis or conflict. China's own military scorecard of 2015 reiterates the nation's strategic concept of active defense, including adherence to the doctrine that we will not attack unless we are attacked, but we will surely counterattack if attacked. China also voices alarm about the scope of its adversaries' space achievements and ambitions. Outer space has become a commanding height in international strategic competition. Countries concerned are developing their space forces and instruments, and the first signs of weaponization of outer space have appeared. Responding to the perceived hostile conditions in language not very different from that of its adversaries, China vows to keep abreast of the dynamics of outer space, deal with security threats and challenges in that domain, and secure its space assets to serve its national economic and social development, and maintain outer space security. The rhetoric resonates with America's own ambitions in space, although the long-lived U.S. theme of space superiority is absent. As for space security, in the summer of 2016, China took a great leap forward in that direction when it launched the world's first quantum satellite, which offers the promise of eventual hack-proof communications for everything from your pet food purchase to the military's surveillance operations. Say a country has stashed a few ballistic missiles, missile interceptors, and high-energy lasers around the globe to discourage attacks on its own satellites. Now, if it chooses, it can also readily attack another country's satellites, however unwise such a move would be. If that same country adds some surveillance reconnaissance platforms and satellite communication jammers to the mix, it will have what the United States calls counterspace, defensive as well as offensive measures meant to enable military agility and resilience capacity for the purpose of ensuring space superiority. Existence of and access to these technologies enables actions that would be impossible without them. Just as access to a military-style semi-automatic assault rifle enables actions that a knife does not. When most people hear the phrase space war, they're not thinking weaponless cyber sabotage. They're thinking actual, powerful weapons causing colossal explosions hundreds or thousands of miles above Earth's surface. While possession of an arsenal is not synonymous with war, it can prove either a prelude to war or war's strongest deterrent. A stockpile of bombs, missiles, and lasers is a stockpile of bombs, missiles, and lasers, whether acquired in the name of deterrence, protection, or attack. It can be deployed in both offensive and defensive actions. The difference is not inherent in the weapons themselves. One de facto category of space weapon has nothing to do with intentional deployment, space junk. It's already up there. The inevitable but inadvertent result of smash-ups, explosions, rocket launches, spacewalk maneuvers, the ordinary dumping of trash, and the inevitable demise of assorted spacecraft. From a distance, it looks like a cloud of dandruff ringing our planet, mostly in low Earth orbit because that's where most satellites are found. But space junk populates all of nearby space, extending 6 Earth radii out to the zone of geosynchronous satellites. Besides a few notable mementos of the late 1950s, such as the final stage of the launch rocket for the USSR's first Sputnik, and the entirety of America's first Vanguard, hundreds of thousands of unguided bits of flotsam and jetsam orbit Earth amid our working satellites. Included in the debris are a couple of cameras, a dropped wrench, a glove, multiple bags of garbage, and blobs of unspent rocket fuel, all harmless until they plow into the belly of a satellite or space station at an impact speed as much as 10 times faster than a rifle bullet. At that speed, even a paint chip causes real problems. As with our planet's so-called Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a continent-sized region in the Pacific Ocean that's infused with suspended plastic fragments, dumped cargo, fishing nets, and chemical sludge, space garbage is a growing risk, unpredictable and largely unmanageable, at least until some technical breakthroughs give humans more control. Currently, the Space Surveillance Network tracks 20,000 pieces of debris that are grapefruit-sized or larger. 500,000 more are smaller than a grapefruit, but larger than a cherry. Millions more are smaller still. Given the many capabilities, threats, and challenges created by the human presence in space, rational people have long mobilized against warfighting beyond the clouds. The most concrete results of these efforts are a handful of international treaties and resolutions, some of them voluntary. Legal instruments and voluntary agreements, of course, present very low hurdles to anybody willing to prosecute a fight by every means available. All-out war in space is still a hypothetical, but it's certainly on many drawing boards, and many of the weapons that would be used to wage such a war, whether under the banner of deterrence, denial, or destruction, already exist in some form or are in well-funded development. In past military parlance, notably in On War by the early 18th century Prussian general Karl von Clausewitz, war was referred to as an art, firmly rooted in strategy and heavily dependent on the wise planning and psychological astuteness of a commander. The presumption was that warriors were fierce and strong and their weapons deadly. but the nature of the weapons themselves was often subordinated to questions of how and when they would be used. Sun Tzu, the oft-quoted 6th century BC Chinese general, barely mentions weapons in his Art of War, singling out only the use of fire. By the beginning of the 2nd millennium AD, detailed writings about weaponry such as gunpowder-propelled fire arrows and rockets for military use rather than fireworks displays were appearing in both East and West. Common early weapons such as arrows, axes, clubs, swords, scythes, and spears were grasped in the hand and meant for close combat. The Iliad, epic chronicle of the final year of the 13th century BC Trojan War, offers a cornucopia of grisly details of death by spear. And the bronze spear point plunged in his brow, then penetrated bone. Darkness covered his eyes, and he fell like a tower in the mighty combat. He struck him down through the right buttock, straight through into the bladder, under the bone the spear point passed. He dropped to his knees, screaming, and death embraced him. As well as by rock. But the son of Tydeus took in his hand a boulder, a great feat which two men could not lift. With this he struck Aeneas on the hip joint, and the jagged stone crushed his hip socket, snapped the tendons on both sides, and forced the skin away. With the emergence of fortifications and ship-to-ship or ship-to-shore engagement, there arose a need for new kinds of weapons that would be effective at greater distances. Artillery superseded the arrow and the spear. The challenges of distance reputedly also gave rise to practices such as catapulting beehives or diseased corpses over a city wall, or even leaving obvious caches of not obviously poisonous honey to be consumed by an enemy's advancing troops, early versions of biowarfare. Such innovations in weaponry sometimes proved as important as a commander's clever strategizing. By the late 15th century, Leonardo da Vinci would conclude that the best way to recommend himself to a potential patron, Ludovico Sforza, the Duke of Milan, was to foreground his manifold skills in designing the machinery of battle, from portable bridges to big guns, mortars, and light ordnance of fine and useful forms, and other machines of marvelous efficacy and not in common use, adding only as an afterthought, "I can carry out sculpture in marble, bronze, or clay, and also I can do in painting whatever may be done, as well as any other, be he whom he may." Helping to equip armies promised to be a surer way for Leonardo to support himself than painting portraits and religious murals, a pattern that has held across the ages. Commentators often invoke Clausewitz's famous dictum concerning the nature of war, that it is a mere continuation of policy by other means. But war and weapons can also be considered as problems in physics. Virtually all weapons ever devised are means of moving energy from here to there. Here is the device on one side of the conflict. There, some distance away, is the enemy or the enemy's property. The device can be a boomerang, a bullet, a catapult, a cannonball, a harpoon, a trident, a grenade, a ballistic missile, a bomb, a laser. The energy can be in the form of kinetic mass, fissionable material, explosives, incendiary chemicals, light. The physical agenda, omitting all considerations of politics, law, religion, commerce, history, hatreds, honor, and the like, is to deliver that energy to a pre-selected location where it can kill people and break things. Non-biological, non-explosive modern weapons are of two main types: those that propel a certain amount of mass at high speed against a target, kinetic energy weapons, and those that send destructive energy, chemical, nuclear, or electromagnetic, against a target, directed energy weapons. A barrage of bullets fired at a line of soldiers 100 yards away is a kinetic energy weapon, while a downward-pointing laser aimed by an orbiting satellite at the main generator of a city's water purification plant would be a directed energy weapon. Or how about examples from science fiction? Both Star Trek's photon torpedo and Star Wars' proton torpedo are kinetic energy